You're listening to Red Setter, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Setter. I'm Mike Seymour.
And I'm Jason Wingrove. Hi, guys.
This week on the show, we're recording this right after Macworld, or rather I should say WWC, but the replacement for Macworld, I guess, in terms of developing and showing new stuff that's happened in the Mac. We're going to discuss that from a digital cinematography point of view. Also coming up later in the show, we have a discussion with Philip Bloom, who is hasn't actually shot on the Red per se. He tends to shoot on like sort of P2 with lens adapters, and also pretty heavily on the
5D Mark II and the GH1. So it's interesting to talk to someone who's sort of crossing that bridge and creating stuff with adapters that really pushing that tech to its limit, really, and getting some really nice images.
We'll also have a quick look at the new Build 18 prototype Red color science stuff and see what that is doing and what it's not doing for Jason. We'll also have a look at some questions that you guys have sent in and some corrections or some points that you've illuminated us on, which we asked you for. We really appreciate that.
And shortly we're going to cross to David Strapinis, who's doing a report on the ground at CineGear Expo for us. So thank you.
But let's get started with the news. And Jason, we talked about people sending in emails and stuff for us, but in fact we had a bunch of other emails.
Look, everybody who sent some really positive comments about the direction we're taking in expanding our, not moving away from Red, but just looking at other facets to the art, to the craft, and other ways of getting to point B without spending trillions and trillions of dollars, 5D Mark IIs, and all the sort of evolving gear, and not just at the capture end, but in post and workflow. So, yeah, thanks everybody for your positive feedback so far. Nothing negative. Don't start. But nothing negative so far, so it's been great. Thank you very much. Another feedback was when I was discussing with Jim Hare the multicam red footage.
OB van stuff. Yep.
Yes. A couple of people emailed and Twittered back to me about OB vans, which I had no idea means nothing stateside. I think it's the same in UK, that OB van is an outside broadcast van, which stumped a lot of listeners because it's
actually sports events with tons of cameras feeding into them.
Exactly right. Which in the States is called a live van. So yeah, apologies for that. I didn't really realize it was called anything else but an OB van. So there you go.
So we were discussing this fact that the WWCC thing has just happened and the MacBooks have come out. And just in terms of from a digital cinematography point of view, this is an invaluable tool for me on set. I mean, I use the MacBook Pro mine a lot. I have the 17-inch at the moment and haven't upgraded. You've actually have upgraded yours relatively recently.
Yeah, to the 15-inch. And one thing that they've since I've bought this, they've literally just refreshed that whole line MacBooks and MacBook Pros today. And the weird thing, which I cannot get my head around, is they've deleted the Express slot. I guess it's the official name is the three quarter or 3/4 express slot, and I threw it out to Twitter this morning just about who's actually going to miss this card, and there is a lot of people who use this slot for running eSATA adapters running through to RAIDs on set. A lot of DIT guys use them because if you're running a RAID or running a drive off the FireWire 800 port, you've got to use the eSATA port. You've got to use an eSATA adapter on the 3/4 slot. So they've replaced it with a really, I've got cameras that have got SD slots, but they're essentially taking away a pro interface and added an ST card slot, which I can understand that in a MacBook, but not a MacBook Pro. Okay.
If it had a compact flash card reader on the side,
exactly.
I'd be pretty excited
about
that because I'd put that stuff on my head or my
or a 14-in-1, a 14-in-1 card adapter or something like that. But to take away something pro in a MacBook Pro and add something fairly amateur, obviously a lot of cameras do use them, but to add that feature I think is weird. The Express slot is still there on the new 17 inches, but to be honest, I've moved away from the 17-inch. I sort of ummed and ahed about it, and I've now got the 15-inch, and I do not miss the 17-inch at all, especially the weight. When I pick up my bag, I'm I have to double check that whether the laptop's still in there, actually, because it's so light. And the bag I now carry, the crumpler bag that suits the 15 inches, even the bag itself is lighter than the bag I used to drag the 17 inch around in. So you really do. It's so much nicer to walk down an airplane aisle without whacking people in the head with a huge 17 inch bag.
That's me. I mean, I think the thing that I'd really like to see is being able to use the solid state drives, because I've looked at those and they are incredibly fast, and I can see a lot of application that if we could get the capacity up on those. The trouble is I'm on a 500 gig drive on my 17 inch and I really need that, because R3D files, R5D files, they're all big, be them stills or video and stuff, and
yeah.
I just need a buffer, because obviously they're not properly calibratable in the sense that you can try and get the color space pretty close, but you can't get them to a broadcast quality. And yet people are judging color off their laptops and are judging images, and I certainly do that. I mean, I use it for on-set compositing. We discussed that in an earlier episode, you know, getting a feed from the RED camera into my laptop, and then I'm doing, you know, 720p comps on set to align foreground green screen with backgrounds. But, I mean, we use an Arja box for that, which converts it to FireWire 800, which feeds in. So I really think that it's a...
So they are actually, they've got a better color space than
theoretically, older, the non-LED. Gamut on the new ones that were released today is 60% better, which basically means they're filling in a lot of gaps or a lot of holes in the gamut, which produces more faithful color.
Well, I was worried going to the glossy screen, but I've got to say I really, really like it. The screen is so bright, it kind of, you don't notice the reflections behind it.
Well, the other thing on set, and you must know this more than I do because you do so much more commercials work, but So much of the agency staff are going to be judging stuff off their laptop. And, you know, the bottom line is one of the other things they fixed today is the QuickTime Gamma. Well, we think they fixed the QuickTime Gamma problem.
Man.
That's so annoying.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm spitting out a little edit at home, I don't often edit my own stuff, but if I'm doing an animatic or whatever it be, to spit out an edit and email it to someone and look at it, and it's completely different, you know, and realize you've got, well, I've got the version I'm seeing on the screen, this monitor looks different, and I look at this QuickTime, it makes you kind of sort of...
The QuickTime is definitely
annoying. It makes you sort of, you know, want to kind of double-check things, go, hang on, is this the right thing, or is
and
that
do you
the right
down
thing?
The original, darker to try and offset
it. Yeah, then you've got to spit out, do this trial and error thing, and as you spit out QuickTime, add filters or tweak it or add more contrast, and just to try and get the QuickTime to look like your cut. So if they fix that, then, you know, that is a big hallelujah for a lot of people. That's a big pain. So hopefully one good thing and one stupidly weird thing. Anyway. The next thing is in the Red news is there an update on the Red Rocket card.
Just before we discuss that, can I just laugh at a Twitter that you put out during the week about how expensive it was to have film stock on your film shoot during the week?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a client that has a no digital.
Yeah, they do nice quality.
And there's a lot of them.
There's no problem with the quality of it. It was just the cost of it, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, when the budgets aren't great, I mean, I've talked about this before. It's just to spend, essentially, what we ended up, we were doing three commercials in a day, and I shot about pretty much bang on 10,000 feet, which when I did them, I think, hang on, I checked my producer, what do we budget for 35? It's about $1.75 per foot.
Now,
to purchase the film.
Yeah, the stock.
And to process it. That's
right.
Purchase and process, $1.75.
Does that include Telecine?
No.
Okay.
So discarding any of that or neg matching and, you know, syncing up, all that sort of stuff. Essentially, 10 grand a film at $1.75 a foot ends up being $17,500.
It's about the price of a red one.
Which is exactly the same goddamn price as a red one. Which, I mean, obviously, no accessories, and that's just American dollars. But, hey, let's not let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Well, the point is, it's not like you've only do one ad in your
life. The point
is
that, yeah, just in a day, I've ripped through enough
Tell me, is 10,000 feet a standard kind of amount for you to shoot?
That's a little bit high. I would normally, probably for one sort of 30-second commercial on a day, I'd probably shoot about 6,000 or 7,000.
So, were you getting 400-foot loads? Or?
Yeah, 400-foot loads.
So, how many cans is that? Because I used to think that in the old days, you'd go about...
Come on, you're the maths dude. 400 into 10.
So, basically, on a light day, we do 10 cans, and on a heavy day, we do 20 cans, which is the difference between 4,000 feet and 8,000 feet. And so, you'd actually get up to... That sound about right for you? Like, on a light day, I mean a light day for shooting, which is often effects work, when we take a lot of time to set stuff up.
Yeah.
We do four cans of so somebody, because I used to work in a production company, obviously, as a, not maybe that isn't obvious, I used to work in a production company.
Yeah.
We used to shoot just like a normal production company.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was the post coordinator, so I was basically the producer of post. I handled the visual effects, but obviously I was on set all the time. And yeah, we used to just as a rule, if it's in effects intensive work, we'd have about 10 cans, obviously another five normally on standby.
Yeah.
And then we'd have 20 cans if we were shooting drama, because, you know, the tendency to roll more for performance.
Yeah.
Whereas effects, you tend to sort of set it up more and then...
Yeah. You know. That is a lot for a day. That's about 25 rolls, so that's a lot.
Yeah.
And I would not probably normally do about half that, but we were doing three spots in a day, and we had dogs and kids and old ladies.
Dogs and kids, right.
And food and product and you name it, and we had to sort of really power through it.
Hey, and what stock do you like shooting on?
I don't really have any preference for stock.
No, I think we shot Kodak, I think we, and Fuji?
No, I don't personally. This was actually, I think we shot Fuji, and normally it would just be Kodak or just whatever's going. Most DPs would favour the Kodak, and we just normally get the 320 ASA tungsten, or 500 actually, and go with the 500. But this was, I just happened to see boxes of Fujis off to one side. So I don't like to, you know, enforce any kind of stock preference on people, to be honest. I think for me, the difference between, you know, different brands of stock is just
comes
like,
out in the DI. In other words,
yeah, it's just kind of like blowing across the controls of the, just bumping one knob in Telecine would be the difference for me, in the difference between the two. I know that's being very puerile, and there's probably thousands of people out there going,
The speed of the stock I would care about.
Yeah,
like if
definitely.
Somebody said to me, we were going to shoot, you know, 200, 500, whatever, versus that I would care about, versus really not particularly caring whether I was shooting Fuji or Kodak.
Yeah, I'm presuming it's 500 ASA. We definitely needed it towards the end of the day because, I mean, it's winter here. We've got quite short days.
And they are short days, aren't they?
We were shooting outside. Yeah, definitely. I mean, sun was coming up at 7 and going down at 4:45 or something.
But I cut you off from all that because that was an aside. You were about to talk about the Red Rocket update. By the way, already placed our order.
You've already placed your order?
Yep.
Right, very good. Yeah, so Silverado systems, considered, I'm not sure if they're the only reseller, but they are now registered as a reseller for the Red Rocket. You can get in there and start ordering now.
Does that flag just the Red Rocket as a reseller, or is Silverado selling more than...
Oh, Silverado do tons of stuff.
No, but more Red stuff. Like, do they...
Well...
Because Red hasn't traditionally had resellers of their cameras and stuff.
No, definitely
they have offices
not.
In like Absolutely. London and
yep, they've got you know offices. They've got they've got a facility in London now. But you can't go pick up your camera from London wherever it is in the world. If you're buying a new Red one today, it won't go through any reseller. It'll definitely gets
even
FedExed.
From their own London office. You can't pick it up.
No, that's right.
I didn't know that.
No deliveries. You've got to go. You have to have be FedEx straight out from Red. So, which kind of makes sense, I guess. For the moment, hopefully, I guess as things change and we eventually get a service facility in Australia.
So, as we move out of the news and into feedback, I have something that I wanted to pick up on that was a discussion we had earlier. If you remember, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had a discussion about batteries, and I did some investigation after that because I felt a little... poorly informed for how I should have been for that. And one of the key things that I didn't mention that was very, very important is covering the contacts of the batteries. So just a follow-up on that, and somebody sent me an email about it. One of the really key things that they're looking for in terms of the battery is that the battery contacts are not unexposed.
Right.
This is why it's significant if the battery is plugged into something. So if the battery is on the camera, the idea is that it's safer. Now, I was not sure why they thought that. I've since learned it's because the contacts aren't exposed. So if you are traveling with batteries that are unattached, you need to get a piece of gaffer tape and just put it over the contacts and possibly put it in its own Ziploc plastic bag. The purpose of putting the Ziploc plastic bag is simply to, again, guarantee that the contacts can't come in contact with anything else. And that's what they're worried about. Another tip that somebody sent in to me, which I thought was a great idea, is to do that and print out their own FAA in America guidelines that says that. And then when the guy kind of goes, you can't have this loose battery, you go, yes, I have, because I'm following the guidelines here from the website and the contacts are covered. And that will make a big difference in the acceptability of getting the batteries through
Yeah.
Especially domestic in America.
Right. Take the batteries off your camera as well. Yeah. Get them all off. Get them all into one easily inspectable case with all taped contacts and the printout.
Yeah, and separated. And then the printout to prove it, yeah.
Right. Yeah, you don't want batteries sort of... I mean, if you short those things out, man, you think, oh, well, it's only going to, you know, it's only whatever how many volts it is, 12 volts, it's not going to, you know, how bad can it be?
Lithium,
man, they can do some serious damage.
Yeah, now that was, and that is the big central point to, as the takeout. And once you understand that, as now I do, it makes a lot more sense. And you also had some feedback on the Sony Vegas from, I think, last week's show.
Yeah, because obviously we, not knowing too much about it, got an... I obviously said, look, if you use it, let us know. And I got some great feedback from people who use it and love this thing. So it's really interesting. Ricky from Scotland said, coming from a music production background myself, I found Vegas dead easy to get to grips with, and it just does what you want without having to negotiate a million menus. You just get the work done with minimal fuss. Throw in DV, HDV, AVC, HD, whatever frame rate in one timeline, and it just works.
This was a thread that we got from most of the Vegas users. They found it to be fast and simple.
Yep. Dean Patterson from creativeguys.tv said, I cut on Vegas and have never used a faster system. It's dirt cheap, really stable, and 64-bit upgrade for the software was free. He's used it for 5 years, and you can put any mixed stuff in timelines, as Ricky said. There's no playback lags. You can just... it's dirt cheap and stable, and so everyone just really, really, users really love it. So it's quite impressive.
And just to follow up on the Canon 5D Mark II firmware release, which is obviously now well out in the field and allowing people to do most of the things they want.
Yeah, well, it seems to be out there, and everyone's definitely having some good results with it. I'm hoping to get my hands on one soon. I guess. It's getting... I mean, I still think the whole... I won't get too much into the whole sort of 24, 25p thing, because that's still really a major stumbling block for me to actually... can shoot great images, but if I can't use them really practically, then it's still a non-starter for me.
We had a lot of interest over that discussion over 24, 30. A couple of people thought that we maybe didn't understand the problem fully, which... It's one of the troubles with the podcast is that we could get uber technical and lose a significant proportion of the audience, or we could try and keep it conversational and less lecturing. And I don't know if we walk that line, but that's the line we're trying to walk. We do understand some of the issues that you guys have highlighted. We don't think that the cameras are shooting fields. We were discussing fields because clearly even if you shoot 24 frames a second film, when it gets telecined, it goes to a format that, while it is still progressive, actually still has fields, because the transmission standard has fields.
Yeah.
And that's where that standards conversion discussion came from. I guess somebody really wanted me to just really say point blank what the two problems are, and let me just say them really clearly. It is hard to convert from 30 to 25 without artifacts. It is therefore important for overseas markets and for areas like that that happens. It's not hard to convert from 24 to 25. And, of course, it looks more filmic in 24, even if you're producing for a NTSC country in 24p mode. And those are the two big things, really, the overseas markets and trying to increase everything you can do to make the image look more filmic.
Yeah.
But I had some long emails on that one.
Yeah. I mean, horses for courses. If you're using it and you're not getting any issues, and your conversion method to get it to 24 or 25, you're not seeing any issues, terrific. But there is no seamless, pristine way of getting from 30 to 25 without there being some issues. You just can't drop 5 frames every second and just win that.
Plus, of course, if you're putting things out on the net, who wants to put out
30
frames on the net when you can put out 24?
Absolutely. I've seen tons of wonderful stuff on the net, and, you know, stuff if you're shooting stuff as a journalist that's just going to go straight out into feeds. It's, you know, fabulous, fantastic. It's
a lot less data.
It's, horses for courses.
Hey, you know, we also talked about the DSLR remote, and I have it, and I've been playing with it.
Right, yeah.
I had a shot with it this weekend. We were doing time-lapse with it. Tremendously helpful in time-lapse I shouldn't say time-lapse, stop motion.
Right.
Because we can see the image.
Yep.
And that meant that the camera is quite often for stop motion position, not a particularly convenient place. If you have a camera with live view, you can sort of stand back and look at it a bit.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you don't have live view, you're sort of trying to get your eye up to the eyepiece to see that it's still looking good through the lens, it's much, much easier to check that. Now, it doesn't have onion skinning that lets you, you know, check things and playback and stuff, but look, it's really convenient to be standing up at a different point to where the camera is, because that's a good place to get in to do the stop motion and actually lean in to move per frame, and be able to have that remote just in your other hand so you can see what's going on. The only thing that I've discovered as a criticism of it, and it's a pretty weird criticism, I want to show it to people at parties. And I pull it out and I press the button, and the first thing that happens is it comes up with a menu saying pick your camera server, of which, of course, I don't have one at a party. Right. So that never lets me show the UI. If it just showed the UI and had like the last picture taken, they would sell more of them, because I would be able to sell more of them for them by saying, people, look here. Now, it's not hooked up to a camera, but imagine it was, I could adjust these settings.
It's
but
pretty sad. That, huh?
It just comes up with a blank screen that says, pick a camera. You go, well, I can't pick one. Well, I'm not going to let you get any further. Stop there.
Yeah. It's kind of sad how a lot of parties degenerate into, what iPhone apps have you got? Or you amuse the kids, you just give them, you know, give them something on the iPhone to play with, and it inevitably ends up being all the adults that are going, oh, cool, what's that? And, oh, hey, I'll show you this, that's fabulous. Here's Old Booth, or what's that fabulous, the gravity sort of physics, touch physics.
Touch physics. Yeah. Hey, you know, the thing that I found, though, is, and maybe this is completely relevant, but there is a great app for doing depth of field and calculations with lenses. It's about $20 though. And I find myself pushing back from spending $20 on an iPhone app. And then I stopped myself and I thought for a second, well, hang on, if this was an app I was buying in the Apple store next door, I'd expect to spend $100.
Absolutely.
If or it was a pro app, I'd expect to spend $499.
Yeah. And it is a pro app, that one. I forget the name that you're talking about because I haven't bought it.
Is it a PCAM?
Yeah. PCINE. I can't remember it. I'm sorry. We'll put the link in the show notes to the correct one. But, I mean, as you say, I mean, back in the old days, back in my time when I was a focus baller, we'd have to run, you'd have to get like the old, Casio Zorus or whatever, and you'd have to buy the memory card, the Panavision memory card, to run it. And, you know, the machine itself would be $200 or $300, then the card would be a couple of hundred bucks. And so, you know, really expensive. And, you know, even the plastic, the Guild Kelly charts or the Samsung charts, the physical plastic like slide rulers you have in your hand, they're hundreds of dollars as well. So to get something on your iPhone in front of you, you know,
well, this one I'm talking about actually has fall off for underwater photography.
Really?
So it's not like it's pulling punches. It's just it seems so rough that $20 is an unacceptable amount of money to charge for a terrific app.
I'm sure if you're a focus baller, this is obviously something you need. I mean, there is. I'm sure there's a simple depth of field calculator in the IC4K more red camera orientated app, which for those of you who haven't seen it, one will do, you know, field of view, and actually will do like storage and data storage and how much storage you need for a certain frame rate for a certain codec, and you know, do a lot of, will actually tell you if you're okay. What if I'm running 4K onto the drive at 16:9 at RC36. What's my maximum frame rate on what? And then if I go to the CF card to one, what will be the frame? You know, there's a lot of calculations there. Sometimes, you know, not that I need to know this, but there's a lot of people who, you know, if you need to answer those questions real quick, if you're the first AC and someone says, okay, I want to get down here, we're on the Steadicam running and I want to shoot 36 frames a second, can I do it? Do we need to go to the CF card or do I need a SSD drive or whatever? So definitely that's a cracker. Okay, so you've got it there.
So the one you're talking about is the red one.
Is IC4K.
That is great. And I was on set on a red shoot and somebody had that question and four people went for their iPhones. But the one that I'm referring to is actually PCAM. It's not $20. It's $40. $40 US.
Right.
And PCAM is, by everybody I know that has it, absolutely brilliant.
Yes, it has a great UI.
Oh, yeah.
One of the fantastic UIs is the one that for field of view, where you can essentially looks like shows you a picture of a person. Like, this is a close-up, and if I change my lens to a different, you know, what lens size, or if I go to 4, I think it might even have, you know, stuff for red cam and 4K and 2K and stuff like that. So you can say, if I'm at 4K to get a medium close-up of somebody, and I want to overcrank and I want to go to 2K, what lens do I need to sort of change to without moving the camera to get the same field of view? So it's a very nice, really well thought out. And David Eubank, who's developed this, has developed all of the iterations of this software before. So this isn't someone new who's done this. This guy's been making this software for a long time, for the Mac and for Palm and stuff like that. So this is you know, like next gen.
And yet we still, I certainly have not bought it yet because I bought it for $40.
No, definitely. But look, hey, if you're a first AC, you need to buy this one and not any of the cheap versions because it's really, really well thought out.
So let's switch our attention to Red for a second, exclusively, and I wanted to discuss Red Space. And Jace, we had a couple of emails back during the week between you and I when you were seeing some of the tests that were being posted on Red User. And I think for good reason, because some of the tests show Build 17 versus Build 18 Alpha, where you really can't actually see a heck of a lot of difference.
Not me. I mean, it's a little bit hard. Everything is like Macbeth charts and stuff. So I'm really hoping for a bit of, for me anyway, for the director brain.
Well, I think for me, the thing is that if you are shooting stuff at 5,000, which is the sweet spot of the sensor as is on the Build 17, then going to Build 18 isn't going to produce, I don't believe, like, look, I don't have it. My camera's on a feature at the moment, so I'm not shooting with Build 18. But it's not going to primarily be something that I would expect to see a vast amount of difference in, because we're on the sort of sweet spot on Build 17. If you go to the same thing on Build 18, I think they would expect them to look relatively similar. Where I expected to see a difference, and I'm certainly seeing it in the stuff that's being posted on Red User, is in noise levels, and especially in the blue channel in tungsten. And there we are seeing a dramatic reduction in noise, and I think that's important. I think that's really significant. And in these particular cases, the color temperature that we're talking about in the shot that I'm looking at right now, for example, is 3,200. Big difference from 5,000. It's also a material that's being shot at high ISO. So, for example, one of the really standout different clips will show you something shot at 2,000 ISO at tungsten. And just dramatic difference, even from a JPEG, you can see in the noise level that follows. And so somewhere between I shoot in the sweet spot and I'm shooting tungsten at 2,000.
Yeah.
You know, depending on where you are, you're either going to declare this new build to be God's gift to, or rather Graham's gift to the community, or you're going to think that it's, you know, really not that significantly different.
Yeah. Well, what I was hoping for was the kind of fix for the issues I discussed in my shoot like a few episodes back, where colors were all out of whack, and, you know, I mean, we've touched on that a fair few times, but it's sort of been lauded as being as a dramatic an improvement as when Build 16 came, which I definitely saw as an amazing change from 15 to 16. It really started to look a lot more filmic, and so I'm seeing a lot of side by side. As you say, it's really it is definitely coming into play in the noise in high ISO shots, but
and in the blue channel.
In the blue channel,
which is important if you're doing blue screen work, of course.
Yeah, because a lot of the every time, you know, I mean, for me, every time if there's any green screen involved, every man and his dog goes, oh, well, don't shoot red with green screen. You know, for any green screen footage, it's terrible for green screen. It's just no good. It's not sensitive. And it happens all the time. Definitely, it's, you know, there's a lot of bullshit out there. Rightly
so
or wrongly.
Much green screen on dwarf, and it was all keying like a dream.
There is a lot of negative stuff out there about the green screen. So if this is going to help, then terrific.
Well, let's
so obviously, once that comes a bit more online and it comes out of alpha and we start sort of seeing the real world and get our hands on it and you get your camera back, then we'll be touching more on this and the developments for Build 18 and what's that really going to mean for the real world rather than comparing one Macbeth chart to another one.
Absolutely. We haven't been able to put it through its paces because we're just simply not on the alpha, and nor could we be because we unfortunately don't have our camera. Well, actually, fortunately, because if I wasn't renting the darn thing, I wouldn't be able to buy an Epic when it comes along.
Absolutely.
Hey, we're going to now get an update on what's been going on in Los Angeles with David Strapinas. David's going to join us on the line in one moment. And then after that, coming up in the Red Room, we're going to have a chat, as we said earlier, to Philip Bloom. But now let's cross to David in Los Angeles. David, thanks for joining us on the line.
Oh, not a problem.
Now, for those of you that don't know David from perhaps, say, the VFX show, David is a VFX artist, a very accomplished one, also a post expert and a bit of an expert in the field of virtual cinematography. And David, you've just been out to CineGear Expo, haven't you?
I was this past weekend. It was only 3 blocks from my house, so worked out quite well.
So that's something that happens annually, and this year it was at the Paramount lot. I don't know if it's always at the Paramount lot, but it was at the Paramount lot in Hollywood. And this is really the go-to place for seeing professional camera gear in an exterior kind of location where, and I believe it was incredibly popular this year.
It was a very, very nice day here in Los Angeles. It was sunny and not too hot, and the actual location was outside, and it was like the best farmer's market ever, because there's just these little tents along the sides and packed with people. And unlike a lot of other trade shows like NAB or what have you, this doesn't concentrate on the post-production, so you don't see a lot of the software vendors around. It's really all about really focused on cinematography. So, you know, it's camera rigs and lighting solutions and, you know, the cinematographers union, but it's everywhere you look is stuff that you can never afford and stuff that you you actually can afford, which was really nice. It was cool.
So tell us, what was the sort of standout impression you got, just as an overall impression before we get in? Was there any sort of trends, anything that you noticed as an overall vibe this year?
I thought the thing that was noticeable was that the Canon 5D was everywhere, and I do mean everywhere. Almost every single booth that had anything to show was showing off a 5D mounted on it. The red was quite prevalent, and stereo was a lot of different places as well. It was no love for Nikon, but the Canon was everywhere. I mean, to the point where people were advertising that they rented Red, rented SI2K, and rented Canon 5D, which is, I think, the first time. I'm serious. There were large banners advertising that they had the 5D for rent.
Was it the thought that the 5D is there or is getting there in terms of a tool?
I think that it's there, but I think a lot of people are over enthusiastic about the manual control and haven't really thought about the 30p versus 24p, which I'm not sure if you guys have talked about that, but
we have actually.
Really.
No. Thank you.
Not really.
For that wisecrack.
Yeah.
The thing about the 5D, and there was a, and this kind of ties into Red as well. There are the guys there from Paradise Effects who built the stereo Red rig that was used for My Bloody Valentine and the Hole. Right. And it's a rather massive rig. It's like 94 pounds or something like that. And it's a very, very nice build. You know, the build quality on it was quite spectacular, but it was about the size of an IMAX camera.
Just scare me, those rigs.
They you know, I would be afraid if that thing was, and they had it mounted on a Russian arm that was on a Mercedes SUV, and all I could think is, like, if that arm is swinging around and you're in the wrong place, you know, you're going down hard. That got, you know, when I was talking with those guys, they were very, very, very excited about the Scarlett. And looking around and the 5D as well, one of the things I realized is that if you buy a camera like the 5D and it's so light and so small, your options for what you can own as kit suddenly goes up, because there's a great piece of gear from a company called Portajib. It was a 6.5 foot jib arm that flops down and becomes a dolly track.
Oh, wow.
And it's all packs up into two cases about the size of a rolling, your standard rolling suitcase. And total price for that thing was $4,000. Now, I would never consider buying a jib arm myself. That's the kind of thing I normally rent. but $4,000 for to always have a jib arm and a dolly that I can keep in the bottom of my closet and it's not going to take up room in my house or my car, that suddenly becomes affordable. The fact that it can only hold 21 pounds, including the head and the camera, is very limiting right now. But in a year, you know, when you can mount your 5D or your Nikon that all do 24P and all do have full manual control, or your Scarlett.
You're absolutely right. And you know what? It springs out from there, because on the weekend, as I was saying earlier in the show, I was using the little iPhone app that lets me control my Canon 5D. And with Live View, once that works for video, you could have a camera up the end of an arm, and theoretically I could be standing underneath it with my iPhone and just seeing what the images are and using that almost as a remote monitor just for lining up. Now, none of this stuff competes at the high end with, a major piece of gear, but once you start putting these small things together, that app's $10. As you say, the engineering required for an arm is so much less when it's a tiny lightweight thing. You wouldn't bother doing it for a mini DV camera, but these cameras, the Canon cameras with a really good piece of glass in front of them, are producing pretty nice images.
Oh, absolutely. One of the people I talked to at the show was Zeiss, who, they make absolutely unbelievably beautiful glass. And you can get a full set of primes that I would argue, and I think I would have a good case, that the image quality coming off of that glass is as good as anything, the Red Pro primes or most cinema quality glass, but you can get it for a Nikon mount or a Canon
absolutely.
Mount.
Absolutely, that's the ZFs or whatever, isn't it?
Yeah. I have a set of primes. Total cost for the whole set is under $4,000, and that's glass that it's hilarious with the kind of composite bodies that you have on the digital film backs, that the lens is significantly heavier. For on a 50 millimeter prime than the actual film back.
Yeah.
But it's
guys that make jibs, and as you say, talking about jibs, obviously it's not just if you can make the thing at the end lighter, then obviously you got to carry less weight at the other end, and that means less setup time, easier to transport. It's very simple physics. You need twice the weight on one end than the other. So speaking of jibs, one thing I'm seeing here, which apparently was there at the show, which I believe you've seen, is I'm just wetting my pants with amazement at it, is the a gyro-stabilized head on a boom on a Segway.
Wait, back up. So what have you got?
It's a Segway.
Yeah.
We've all seen Steadicam operators
on a Segway.
Okay, now this is a boom arm. It looks like 7-8, whatever it is, foot long boom on a Steadicam arm on a Segway with a gyro stabilized head, and a second operator is standing off to the side. Well, it looks like you could probably put a lot of things on there. On this one, they've got a 5D on this rig.
Did you see that, David?
I did. Actually, the company that had that there is a company called Filmotechnic, and they're the same ones who had the Mercedes SUV.
Right.
With the red camera mounted on it, and then it was almost like one of those Russian Matryoshka dolls, because they had a series of ever smaller and ever wackier platforms that the camera was mounted on. They had the Mercedes with the big gigantic Russian arm mounted on it.
Yeah.
Then they had a Yamaha four wheeler ATV with a smaller arm mounted on it. And keep in mind that they have the head on the end of this has full 360 by 360 pan and tilt capability, and then they had the Segway with the arm mounted on it that was at that point lying on the ground, but the stabilization that goes into this thing is amazing, because they had the arm out there and the camera sitting there, and the guy just walked up and he punched the top of the arm, and the arm just vibrated like a tuning fork, but the camera stayed absolutely positively still.
I love stabilized heads. There's something about them that is just outstandingly good. And when you're anyone who's tried to throw a camera around really quick and drive real fast and change directions real quick, you need it. You need it. You need stabilization. This is that is like the ultimate in miniaturization. And obviously, things like it looks like the 5D is perfectly built for this little thing. But I'm sure you could put an awful lot of things. It looks like you could fit a red one on.
How much change am I going to get for buying one of those suckers? Do you get any idea on the price?
I don't believe it's actually for sale. I believe it's a rental item only. Yeah. I was trying to talk to somebody in terms of sales or rentals, but all I could talk to were engineers who sounded like they were extras in Eastern Promises. so it was a little hard to get a straight answer. But it was one of the more awesome things. It just made me want to go and shoot a whole bunch of people running through the woods. It was...
What scares me, though, about cameras on Segways is that... I mean, we've all seen... Just check on YouTube for Segway crash, and you're going to see a lot of people doing some serious face plants. This is a very expensive face plant waiting to happen.
Have you done a Segway?
I've been on one, yeah, for a very short... you feel quite safe on them, but, man, I'm not with a Steadicam arm and carrying gear and then taking your hands off and operating the whole thing just with your knees and how you lean.
You ever been on a Segway, David?
I have, and actually all I could think of when I saw the rig there is, you know, you'll see a camera operator on set and they'll have the big Steadicam vest and everything all mounted on them and they'll look like the biggest dork in the world. And all you could think of is, how do you make them look like a bigger dork? Obviously, you put them on a Segway.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one way to look like a real tool, is to get on a Segway, even without a camera.
I like Segways. And,
oh, I love them, but, you know, it's hard to look cool.
It's you know, and obviously you'll have to wear like the most ridiculous bike helmet possible. you know, the ideal thing would have been as if on the handles of the Segway they put like glittering streamers.
and one of those little things in the spokes that goes.
Yeah, put a little card and a peg on the spokes.
Okay, absolutely. So it was tremendously awesome kit. It looked really cool. The kind of thing I like about that kind of stuff, as well as like the ATV, you know, you get that if you're doing your big, you know, action chase scene.
Yeah, that
but
is awesome.
You also then get basically a very, very flexible dolly that, you know, even if you're just doing a slow pan, you know, that needs to go along, you know, following your actors doing it, you get that really, really cleanly. You know, you combine a stabilized head with a Segway, you know, just driving down a road as your characters walk down the sidewalk, and you have a very clean dolly that with very little setup time.
Yeah, exactly, and reset time, you know. I mean, imagine you're looking at a stairwell. You can boom right out over the stairwell, look down, then when the guys are finished walking up the stairwell, they can keep walking towards you, and they can keep going. You're not relying on them not tripping over dolly track or, you know, having to do... put a cut in there somewhere.
So really, it's a weight and size that's being a facilitator for all this stuff, right? Because, I mean, that technology theoretically has been around for a while, but it's not until you get a decent quality camera that's not very heavy that becomes viable to do it for any serious production. Is that what you're saying, Dave?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you could do shots with that would be very difficult to do otherwise. You could do a nice dolly back tracking with your actors and... You know, there's no dolly track that you know in the shot. You know, you can be there's lots of creative things that allows. And also, if you're on an independent film production, that's not necessarily getting all the permits that you should be getting.
if the cops come, you can just segue away really quickly.
Well, there is that possibility, but you also don't have to worry about shutting down a street.
Yeah, but isn't also there a thing that if you put a tripod down in LA, someone will charge you a fee?
Yeah, what tripod?
But if you're shooting from a car, you kind of... Yeah, exactly, what tripod? So what else did you see there that it was of interest? And was the mood upbeat, given the economic... And obviously LA is particularly suffering from that.
Yeah, the mood was a little bit subdued. There's a lot of people looking and not a lot of people buying, it seemed.
A lot of people with free time to go and look.
Oh yeah, a lot of people who are, you know, talking about the lack of work right now.
Yeah.
I guess the other big trend that was really, really evident, you know, once you went inside the soundstage was, LEDs are here to stay because almost maybe 10 vendors were showing off different forms of the next evolution of light panels.
Now, are we talking about small things like the Z90, or are we talking about big light panels? Because, I mean, our problem with LEDs that I've tried is I love them to death, but you need a lot of them to match even a Kinoflow.
Both. Everything from a small, you know, 4x4 square that you could stick into a dashboard in order to do a car shot to full wall illumination. But the big thing that I thought was pretty cool, literally, is the fact that they were running at such a cool temperature that you can manipulate them with your hands. You don't have to worry about burning. You don't have to worry about them setting your set on fire. They run at very low wattage, so yeah. You can actually... I don't see them really replacing studio lights right now, but...
They're definitely going to start getting rid of Kino flows. They're definitely going to start replacing Kinos.
Yeah, that and also I see them really because they don't even the so-called high output LEDs don't really put out a whole lot of light. I do see them as a really good solution for night shooting to just add a little bit of extra fill, and because they operate on such low power, you could probably run them, you know, all night without any problems off of a battery supply. There were also some synchronized fluorescent tube things that were pretty nice. And AJA were there showing off their Key Pro, which a lot of people were very, very excited about.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things I actually went to see.
Yeah, you've ordered one of those, haven't you, David?
I have. I have pre-ordered one, and they're actually doing a launch event here in Los Angeles next week, which I'm going to be going to. But it's a really fantastic piece of kit that can record onto either right to ProRes 422 from onto a hard disk or solid state disk or onto express card, which you can put right into your MacBook.
No, hang on.
Okay.
Yeah, that.
Well, we should talk about that later, Mike.
Yes, yeah. Keep going.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that was in the hangar, which really excited me personally, was a company called Lightcraft had a virtual production studio solution, which was a Canon or a Panasonic prosumer class camera, but it can be really attached to anything. Custom hardware and software that they had, you know, you step up in front of a green screen and they map that out and they put you in front of a virtual set, which is no big deal. You know, we've been doing that for years. You see it every day in the weather, except for the fact that this could work completely handheld in a 3D environment. The matte quality, like the King quality, was really, really fantastic. And in talking with the guys, Lightcraft was founded by a bunch of people who left a company called iRobot, which previously invented something called the Roomba.
Yeah.
So they have a pretty well proven track record in terms of really advancing technology, and it was pretty cool already. But I can see where it'll be in a few years, and I think they're one of those people to watch out for.
And did you see the CMOCOS, the you know the sort of pseudopod kind of robotic Moco arm that premiered there at NAB?
I did, and it was broken. And they said that's why it's not shipping yet. Okay. It was a lot tinier in person than I expected it to be. And I asked if this was just a kind of demo unit or if they had planned on making it bigger, and they did not, which made me kind of question its usability. Because although it had a lot of degrees of freedom, if you can only, you know, move a given amount to the left or to the right or vertically, your usability is limited.
Yeah. Needs to be three times as big.
Yeah, and there's actually solutions coming up from other companies that can do something very similar where it's a live program and play, you know, where you handheld and move it around, and then it will play back on a much, much larger scale, which I can't really mention more specifics than that yet, but...
Well, it sounds like it was a really good show. Thank you so much for taking time out at the end of your day to talk to us about it.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me.
We really appreciate it. We'll try and put some links to some of those cool products that you mentioned, including that fabulous, because I want one of those segues, in the show notes. Thanks so much,
David. See you on a segue, Mike.
Thanks, man. All right. Appreciate it. Bye.
Later.
No, I really do want one of those segues.
Love to see you on one.
I want one. I can justify it somehow.
Absolutely.
If I bought one, would you rent it?
Yeah.
Do you want to buy one with me? We'll share it.
You look like such a tool riding. Not you personally. You know,
no,
you
I would,
just,
but I
anybody
don't care.
On a Segway immediately just, I don't care. You know, just right.
You want to be cool? I don't. I want a Segway. I want one. Okay. So now from one end of the scale, not one end of the scale, one end of the planet to the other, we're going to jump from Los Angeles to London. This is, we're about to play you an actual interview we recorded previously. The reason for this is it was with Philip Bloom, who's in London, and the time zones prohibit us from doing this, as you see here. So what we're going to do is cut to this interview. However, when we cut to the interview, it was recorded with us in three separate locations. So Jason will suddenly no longer be in the studio.
I'll suddenly sound more distant.
Yes, and that's the reason. And this was recorded late at night, Sydney time, so it could be in sync with London. And do you want to set up how we came across Phil? Because really, we've noticed his work online a lot, haven't we?
Yeah, look, he's been absolutely prolific in posting a lot of short films, all done on a lot of actually 35mm adapters on the GH1, Panasonic GH1. He does a lot of work with a lot of depth of field adapters on video cameras, and a lot of stuff on the 5D Mark II. He's absolutely prolific in pushing what I think pushing that tech. I don't want to belittle it, but you know, the depth of field adapters on EX3s and EX1s. He's definitely absolutely screwing every last little bit of quality and art out of them, and really, really some amazing. Particularly his Joshua Tree. I think
you really liked that, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, that was really filmic. I was pretty impressed. He took a PL adapter. There's a PL adapter in development to go on the on the Panasonic GH1, which is a Micro Four Thirds camera, I think, and putting, you know, like Zeiss ultra speeds and a whole bunch of you know, Cine Prime lenses on it and hitting the desert, and so he's definitely he's got we'll give some links to his blog at the end of the interview, but he's not hard to find on the net. He's a master of self-promotion, but in a good way.
Let's cross that interview now.
You're entering the Red Room.
So, Philip, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You've risen to somewhat of authoritative stardom position across the net through your work in both 35mm type adapters for videography as well as harnessing digital stills cameras. So I guess the question you must be asked by almost everybody you meet is, what camera do you like shooting with at the moment? So I'm not going to change that. What do you like shooting with at the moment?
At the moment, I'm enjoying my new toy, the Canon 5D Mark II, which I've had for about 3 or 4 weeks. I just love the lightness of it, the ability to just go out and shoot with something really small and get incredible images.
Yeah, the work that you've been doing also with the GH1, particularly highlighting the EU limitations on record times, have been interesting. How do you compare those two cameras?
They're very different cameras. I mean, the GH1 is effectively a consumer camera. It's handled by Panasonic's consumer division. They don't have any pro stills cameras, and effectively it is a stills camera for them with a video function, although people will be buying it purely for the video function. And that's why I'm trying to highlight the EU rule that needs to be changed, certainly for this camera. I mean, I'm personally willing to pay a little bit extra money to have a non-stop recording ability. It's just great for locked off interviews or wide shots, things like that, where, you know, you don't have that limitation.
So it's an imposed EU rule, is it, the record limit time?
It's a weird one because duty is paid on pretty much every single imported product into the EU, except digital cameras. And to make sure that they don't pay duty, they've the manufacturers themselves limit themselves to 29.59 minutes. So it's 29 minutes, 59 seconds. So they don't have to pay duty. If they go over that, if they make it 30 minutes, they have to pay 4.9% duty. It's a silly rule. It's crazy that we don't actually pay duty on digital cameras and we pay duty on absolutely every other product. But personally, I would rather pay 60 euros and not have the limitations.
Yeah, or at least have an option, have a, even if they called it the pro version and the non-pro version and charge the extra 60 euros just to offset the limit, then people would have a choice.
Yeah. I think they need to listen to the market, because the people who are buying this camera are buying it for its video functions, because if they want a stills camera with the same facilities without the video, they'd just buy the G1, which is much cheaper.
So let's discuss this emerging pattern. And what I'm interested in here is one of the limitations of that camera, which is not widely discussed, and certainly the advantage of the Canon, is just the lensing technology that Canon brings to the party. Do you feel that the lack of range of lenses that are provided or supported by the GH1 will make a difference to the market adoption?
It's interesting. I mean, obviously, there's a huge amount more selection for lenses with the Canon, obviously. There's hundreds of the things, and they're beautiful, fantastic, and quite expensive lenses. But the great thing about the GH1 stock lens and what they've done with it is they've video optimized it. So they've given it the ability to autofocus and things like that, and optical stabilization as well, which are really great video functions in stills cameras, which none of these Canon lenses really can compete with. But obviously the Canon glass is far superior and much more choice. But also you can use 4/3-inch glass with the GH1, just with a simple adapter. The biggest problem you've got with the adapters is that the size of the sensor means that if you're going to stick on a 35mm lens on the GH1, you're going to get 2x magnification. So really, you need to keep lenses on there which are for that correct size. And that is the 4/3 mounts that Olympus made. And I've got a Sigma 30mm f1.4, which effectively is about 60mm on a 35mm camera. And that's a great, fast, standard lens. And there's quite a few of those lenses out there. So there is choice, obviously nowhere near the quality or choice of the Canon lenses.
I've got to say, the footage you shot at Joshua Tree on the GH1 is absolutely standard. It really took me back, I must say, because I was, wasn't expecting an awful lot from essentially, I guess, what is like a 2/3-inch sensor, isn't it? It's larger than 2/3, isn't it?
4/3.
No, it's smaller. Well, no, it's, well, 4/3 is a kind of a weird thing. It's the size of it is probably equivalent to around 16mm, which is very similar to 2/3-inch lenses, 2/3-inch sensors. The 4/3 refers to something different. It's quite a confusing term, because how can you have 4/3? Doesn't make any sense to me. You can have 3/3, and that makes a hole. 4/3 refers to something separately. But if you look at, there is a sensor chart on my web page that actually shows you different sizes, and it is pretty much similar to a 16mm film sensor.
We'll put links into the show notes to it to go and see this, because I was, as I say, really impressed with the cinematic look for, as you say, essentially it's a consumer camera. But part of that shoot was you were using a PL mount adapter for the camera with Zeiss Ultra Primes and a few other pro cine lenses. Can you take us through that project and the test and what it was all about and what came out of it?
Well, basically, Panasonic hired me to make a pretty film using the GH1 and see what I could get out of it for the launch of the camera. And Panasonic Australia are actually going to use it as well at their launch, I think, next week or something. And it's basically, I was out over in the States doing a number of things, and I wanted to go to Joshua Tree, just because I'd never been there before and thought this would be a great place to film. And this guy contacted me called Ilya Friedman, and he's based out of LA, and he works in the movie business, and he is a G1 owner. And he, because of the lack of the mirror box on the G1 and the GH1, he realized he could put on a PL mount lens onto this camera, and also the fact of the image projected from a PL lens is way smaller than a full frame 35mm image. It's actually much more compatible with the 4/3 format. So he thought this is quite a good match. So he basically went out and made himself an adapter, which is going to sell for about $1,000. And I was the only person he knew with the camera. So he hooked up with me and we just wanted to see what it looked like with the lenses. I mean, it looked great, but to be honest with you, if I'd stuck on my my fast Sigma glass, it would have looked great as well. I mean, it's quite a low bit rate on that camera. And, you know, those lenses on that camera is utter overkill, but it was a nice little experiment. I mean, what he thinks the market for that is that Hollywood, when you're making Hollywood film, they have lots of PL glass dotted around the set that they're not using for each shot. So when they're doing stunts and they want to get some extra angles, they're just cutting in these shots for like half a second or 1 second, they could put on some GH1s at different angles, stick on their spare lenses and just capture those extra angles that they wouldn't normally be able to do because they don't have the cameras for it. So that's what he thinks the market's for. And I thought they worked really, really well. I mean, it's ridiculous that you have to hold the camera by the lens rather than hold the camera itself because the lens is so big and heavy.
Yes, but, of course, you've got a bolt. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was fun. It was nice. I mean, I can't imagine me ever doing that again with those lenses. I'd certainly be putting those lenses on 35mm adapters. But certainly not on the GH1 again.
Yeah, so I guess it was testament to a lot of the Panasonic's, the factory lenses that actually probably they all look quite similar.
Yeah, I mean, I would say probably 2/3 of the Joshua Tree film was shot using the stock lens, which is
really
it's a kit lens. It's got a good range on it. It's got a 35mm equivalent of something like 28-240 or something like that. But it's slow. It's f4 at its widest at 4 wide, and so it's not exactly a fast lens. But it performed really well, and it cut together pretty well as well. So I mean, you'll probably notice the shots with the PL on because they're wide open at f/1.9, and it does have that much softer looking background. But I thought they cut together really well.
Yeah, so when we're discussing the rapid adoption and interest in these cameras, would you think that it is primarily driven by getting great quality with interchangeable lenses? I mean, what is it that's really attracting people to using these cameras for shooting moving images?
I think it's the fact that we've been limited to, certainly in low-budget filmmaking, to cameras with very small sensors. We're talking quarter-inch, third-inch, and half-inch. And we've been using 35mm adapters to effectively fool the cameras into having these bigger sensors. And then suddenly, albeit with severe limitations, we have these cameras with much larger sensors which are larger than way, way more expensive cameras. And when we're talking, the Canon 5D Mark II has a bigger sensor in it than the Sony F35. It's got a full frame sensor in, which that one doesn't have. But you look at the price, but there are huge limitations with these cameras. I mean, just the rolling shutter, the wobbly image that you get when you do too much movement. We've now finally got manual control on the Canon 5D this week, I've only had the camera a few weeks, but I know everybody's been after it since the camera came out last year. And the lack of proper audio options on it, many, many things. But you know, when you think about what you're getting for the money, it's quite astounding. And same with the GH1. The GH1 body only retails, although they're not selling it body only in the UK, for £500. I think they're going to £500 for a camera that shoots on effectively a 16mm sensor. That's crazy.
So the interesting thing is going to happen when Scarlett comes out. Scarlett, in its simplest form, was initially promoted as a 5K for 5K. So we're now talking about a camera that's going to be significantly more expensive. We're used to thinking of Reds as being really cheap, but it's significantly more expensive than, say, a Canon 5D Mark II, even with a nice lens on it. Though, of course, the Canon is limited to a 1920x1080 with a somewhat restrictive set of restrictions like the audio, and, of course, the encoding of the vision. How do you think the market is going to react? Is it enough to shoot HD? Does the market want to go above that? Is that extra flexibility something that is going to be the deciding factor?
I think this is a really important point and something I've been highlighting and discussing with my colleagues a lot over the past few weeks, is that the Scarlett has effectively millions of permutations with all the different combinations that they've got. But the one permutation they don't have is just either full HD or 2K. The minimum resolution is 3K. And to be honest, for just about 99% or 99.9% of people out there, they don't need that much resolution. It's lovely to say you can shoot on 5K, but the reality of shooting 5K or even 3K is really not that much fun to actually use in post, and you don't need it. I mean, how many of us are going to shoot these things and going to stick it on an IMAX screen? Very, very few of us.
Well, of course, most the argument would be but the argument would be that with the Telecine, for example, many years ago, we discovered that it was really terrific to do 4K scans of Telecine when you're intending to do HD, because basically the super sampling at Nyquist theory, double the rate that you wanted to go at, produced particularly good results. And so the argument would be, if you're capturing at a native 1920x1080, you're not actually going to get 1920x1080 resolution, whereas if you can capture higher and downsample, you're going to maintain image quality and remove a lot of artifacts that would otherwise be available. Is that enough to sell anyone, or do you think the market won't care?
I honestly think that the extra time and cost in post-processing, people aren't taking into account at the moment. Using the RED 1 and at the moment, using that workflow causes people a lot of issues, and it drives budgets up, and people don't realize just how much of an extra pain having to deal with all that resolution does. I mean, it's great to have the option, don't get me wrong. You know, if I had a project that required me to have all that extra resolution, if I wanted to do some special effects stuff or anything like that and have that extra resolution, it's great to have that option. But it'd be really nice to have the option of just being able to shoot 2K or full HD for most projects, because I still am shooting, I would say, 2/3 of my work in standard definition, and that says a lot.
So let me ask you a question, flipping it the other way then. If we assume that these cameras, these digital SLRs, sit in the middle, the other side of that coin is the amount of money and technology that has been devoted to producing 35mm adapters for cameras like the P2. They produce terrifically good results, but do these cameras also pose a threat to that market, in that it won't be worth it to put a 35mm modifying adapter onto, say, a P2?
From the DSLRs, not at the moment. Until the limitations are affixed and we have proper controls, proper camcorder features that we're used to on proper cameras are there, and it changes from a stills camera with video to a video camera that can shoot stills. There's still going to be a need for 35mm adapters. The Scarlett could well change all that, of course. But then again, if you're looking at the Scarlett with 35mm sensor, I mean, that's a lot more money than the fixed lens 2/3-inch one that they've got coming out. So there's definitely 35mm adapter market is not going to disappear anywhere in the next couple of years. It's still going to be very much a viable way of capturing images beautifully. I was shooting a documentary in Boston last week, half on the 5D and half on the EX1 with the lettuce, and I was doing all of the sync, all of the interviews, all the actuality done on the EX1 with the lettuce, and just some of the more artistic shots or some of the quicker shots I wanted to get with available light, I used the 5D, using it as a B camera. So there's definitely a long way to go before the adapter market disappears.
How are you going into cutting those two together? Because obviously, you being based in a power country, we've got the whole still hanging on to the 30p issue with the fire.
Yeah,
and you're trying to intercut it with 25p footage from your from the other camera.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in compressor and cinema tools working out the best way to convert 30p. 25p, and I've got a workflow that I'm pretty happy with, and I was converting 170 clips last night from 30p to 25p, and they're all done this morning. It took 12 hours to do. I left it running on my Mac Pro, and I looked at the stuff this morning, and it looks fantastic. It's going to cut just great with it.
Now, you're not seeing any issues with obviously being the motion estimating that's going on along the way to get it from 30 to 25.
It's not ideal. I mean, you know, I would want to shoot 25p native on the 5D. I'd want to have selectable 24, 25, or 30p on these cameras, like you get on the video cameras. It's a compromise, without a doubt, and that's what I'm doing. I'm compromising. But most of the stuff that I was shooting on the 5D had very little movement. It was very stylized type shots, yeah. And it really looks fine.
A lot of people get your opinion on cameras. I want to get your opinion on lights for a second, because clearly a reasonable camera shooting well-lit scenes can produce magnificent-looking images. And I'm wondering what sort of lighting kit you tend to use, whether you tend to go with natural light, as you indicated with that Boston project, or you like to take a kit. What's your approach to lighting as a DOP and director?
I like to use available light not as the main source, but certainly make the most of it. And so I tend to use the lights that I use. I use quite a lot of soft lights. I've got some Kino Flow Divas, which I use. I took to Boston with me. I have some Dados, which I use as my my kickers and my backlights. I've got some reefers, which I use a fair bit, and a couple of Arri 650s. Just to get a bit of extra bounce. But I mean, this is like, I don't use all of these lights at the same time. I would just use selective. For example, in Boston, I just used a single Kino Diva and backlight from a window, and it looks great.
So obviously there's a massive difference between, that is obviously where the 5D will really come into its own. There's got to be three or four stops difference between using something with the lettuce, say, and the amazing low light ability of the 5D.
The great thing about the 5D, of course, is the fact that it has this incredible low light sensitivity, which is fantastic for getting those shots at night time. But if you're shooting anything that's got a change of focus and a moving subject, you are going to have this razor thin depth of field. So you're still going to require lighting if you're talking about actually shooting some sort of narrative stuff out there, because unless you've got, you know, the best focus puller in the world.
So that comes from the sort of very close focus range in the Canon stills lenses versus putting, say, Zeiss Ultra Primes on a 35mm adapter. You've obviously got a much greater expanded focus range, and so you're finding it quite hard to sort of do fine focus picking with the stills lenses.
Well, if you're wide open on an f1.4, pretty much on anything really, on a 35mm adapter or the 5D, you are going to find it very, very difficult to pull focus. Sure. Certainly when I was shooting some stuff in Boston, and I was having, you know, deliberately I was getting this shadow depth of field of millimeters, because it just looked so astonishing on sort of like portraits of this old man and stuff like that. But you know, if I wanted to actually have him doing stuff, I'd have stopped down to, you know, 2.8 or even more, and just had a little bit more light on him. Or if there was enough light, just stop down as it is.
Right. So yeah, there was no real sort of major sort of physical differences in terms of the focus. Obviously, cine lenses are obviously designed to, you know, give you a couple of turns from infinity to minimum focus, whereas stills lenses are obviously quite not quite designed that way. So I just kind of imagine
The Zeiss ZF lenses, the Nikon mount ones that I've got, have got an almost 360 degree turn on them.
Yeah.
So they're the best I've come across for that sort of thing. Not quite as good as the cine lens, but they're close.
There are a lot of people that are shooting with Nikon and Canon lenses on, say, the Red camera. Have you actually shot much with the Red yourself?
I've only played with the Red. I've never shot a project on it. I guess, in a way, what's happened is I've kind of created this sort of niche for myself, where people hire me for 35mm adapters. And so they actually come to me saying they want me to shoot on a 35mm adapter, whereas if I hadn't created that niche, they'd probably come to me as a DP and say, we want to shoot in the Red. How do you feel about that? So people aren't coming to me for the Red, but I've got a RED project coming up next month, so it'll be my first proper experience of actually shooting with it. But I say I played with it and had, you know, it's a really nice camera, but no actual proper experience with it yet.
So I might just take me across that niche that you say you've created in the 35mm adapter field. I mean, obviously people are after a certain look rather than a certain piece of gear. So what do you, the niche is the 35mm look that essentially can almost be done with a one-man band, I guess.
Well, I think what it is they want the 35mm look without having to pay the money for it. And that's understandable, especially, with the recession that we've got at the moment, that the budgets are slashed and people are wanting that expensive look and they haven't got the money to pay for it. So they're coming to me because I'm shooting for the same price that they would hire a normal DP with a normal HD video camera. They're getting a 35mm look, which is what they're loving. I shot a commercial for the National Theatre in the UK, which is playing in movie theatres worldwide at the moment, and that's been transferred to 35mm film. The budget on that was tiny. You know, I'm sure in an ideal world, they'd love to shot it on 35mm film, but the budget just wasn't there. So they looked for alternatives, and I think the end result was really great.
Yeah. Well, look, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. We thank you very much for organizing the time zones, and we look forward to following you as you shoot more with the cameras and blog more online. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Again, thank you, Philip, for your time. That was really, really appreciated.
And we're back in the studio now.
And we are back in the studio now.
I can see you.
I'm sounding a lot
better. It's a
little
hard, actually, when the three of us are in a remote location.
It is a little bit hard, the three-way thing, and across time zones and Skype.
Well, we've run our show to a suitably long length again, my friend, so we should probably wrap it up.
Indeed. Again, lots of links to everything we've discussed and the stuff that Mr. Strippin has talked about at Cinegear, all in the show notes. And to links to Philip's blog and all that sort of stuff is at the show notes.
And always, if you want to, you know, jointly buy a Segway with me, send us info at red@fxguide.com. Of course, at fxguide.com you can download all the episodes, including previous ones. Right back, this is, I think, our 37th time together in the chairs. I'm off tomorrow to New Zealand, and I'm going to be talking to some Red users there, so I'm looking forward to reporting on that when I see you next, Jase.
Yep, I'm heading the editing room where I'm editing my Red One's worth of film together into something that a client will hopefully say yes to.
And then next week I'm up actually at Broadcast Asia, so I'll be reporting from there where I'm giving a seminar. She goes for 2 days, though. It's two half days. I'm covering digital, it's basically data workflow. So we're covering capture in terms of what you do in cameras, how you budget them. I'm going to get into a full color space discussion with diagrams. I'm going to do some case studies, including a network case study, looking at how a TV station works with a P2 workflow. And then in the second part, looking at disk and versus data centers, some VFX workflow that we did on Red Dwarf and shooting, of course, with the Red camera, and then distributed production. That's all happening on the seminars during Broadcast Asia.
You're also off to Seagraph.
Yes, I was going to say before that, though, I'm also giving a talk at the same time, a short talk, at a CG Overdrive, which is a concurrent thing at Broadcast Asia, which I'm doing, I think, just for an hour and a half, kind of the action-packed summary version. And then you're right, I actually have to go to somewhere else first, and then I'm going to Seagraph.
Fantastic.
So I'm not talking about this somewhere else yet, but I will, because when we do it, it'll be way cool.
Oh, you tease.
No, it's good.
Okay. All right, cool. Well, I'll just be here in Sydney, and you can reach me on Twitter at twitter.com/Wingrove. And Mike?
I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. And, of course, at fxguide.com you can find out all of the stuff that we're doing, and over at fxphd.com our online training stuff, which will start a new term in the beginning of July. Until then, we talk hopefully after I've been back from New Zealand. Nice talking to you, Jase.
Thanks, Mike. Same to you. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com.
Copyright 2009, FX Guide, LLC.